the extraordinary and tumultuous life of Stalin's daughter.
If you think of yourself as someone who's the daughter of one of the worst historical dictators, responsible for the death of millions, and then you think of how she tried to negotiate that balance between a freedom for herself so that she could be almost cleansed of her father's name. At the end of her life, she was saying, if it could be known that I stood against my father's policy, that would justify my life. And yet at the same time, trying constantly to create this domestic, private world.
That's Rosemary Sullivan. We talk with her about her terrific new biography of Svetlana Stalin, Stalin's daughter. Then another Russian emigre explores the inner divide that splits the soul of the immigrant.
There is almost the splitness of soul that will always be there. I think that immigrants have this split soul, and the longer you live in an adopted country, I think the deeper your roots grow into the foreign soil. But that scar that marks the divide, that divide of the split soul, with time it scabs over, but it doesn't go away.
That's Elena Gorokova. We talk with her about her memoir, Russian Tattoo. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. It's almost unimaginable. What would it be like to be the child of one of history's most brutal and powerful dictators? The award-winning biographer Rosemary Sullivan tells us what it was like for Svetlana Stalin, a woman fated to live her life in the shadow of her father. Yet she struggled valiantly against that fate. A woman of uncommon intelligence and integrity, she tried to live a normal life. She was a loving mother who had to leave two of her children behind. She was a wealthy woman who gave away her riches and ended up living in poverty. She was a brilliant writer who utterly repudiated her father in her books, but was never able to free herself of the taint of him in the eyes of the world. Stalin's Daughter is a fascinating, detailed, and revelatory exploration of the life of Svetlana Stalin, who took her mother's last name, Aleluyeva. Canadian poet and biographer Rosemary Sullivan is the award-winning author of numerous other books, including Villa Air Bell and Labyrinth of Desire. Well, Rosemary Sullivan, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much, Francesca.
You seem particularly suited to write this biography. You've traveled behind the Iron Curtain to the Soviet Union in 1978, also to Czechoslovakia, where you met dissident writers and then worked on human rights for writers. And you've also written a book about women and romantic obsession called Labyrinth of Desire. Why did you want to write a book about Stalin's daughter, Svetlana?
I read her obituary in November 2011, and have to confess I didn't realize Stalin had a daughter. At that very moment, I was talking with my brilliant editor in New York, Claire Wachtel of HarperCollins, and I said, "What do you think, Claire? What could be more interesting than a woman who had to live under the shadow of such a name, especially a father? How complex could that relationship be?" And she said, "Give it a go," and I wrote a 20-page proposal. I read Svetlana's 20 Letters to a Friend, which is an amazing book in that it is so compassionate and so direct and honest, not the book you would expect in your preconceived notion of what a daughter of Stalin would be. And so I said, "Yes, here it is. This is the book I want to write."
So your first impressions of her were in a way positive through her writing.
They were. They were very positive through her writing. Her second book, Only One Year, is a more political book. And her critique of the Soviet Union seemed to me very powerful. I also understood, however, that the story that would not be known about Svetlana was from 1967 forward. What did it mean to defect to the United States in 1967? And how did her life go from that point on? So I set out. This would be my fifth biography. I had written about women before. That's my passion, to understand the female psyche. And so I went to Russia, to Georgia, to London, through the States. I met the CIA officer who took her out of India, which was where she defected. So after 40 interviews and searching the CIA and the FBI files and what Russian files I could have access to in Moscow, the story built in a, I have to say, I think almost to the level of a Russian novel. Only a Russian could live that complex a life.
That's certainly true. I mean, someone who embodied many contradictions in herself, and contradictions that go all the way back to her childhood. Her mother, Nadia, killed herself when Svetlana was only 6 years old. Tell us a bit about her mother and why she might have killed herself.
Stalin's grandson, Sasha Brodonsky, put it very well. Stalin is a kind of sinkhole into which many myths collect. So there are various versions of Nadia's suicide, but the one that seems most compelling to me is the night before, or actually the very night that she committed suicide. There had been a dinner party. Stalin had insulted her. Finally, the difficulty of their domestic life and her opposition to his politics, she got to the point, I think, that she saw there was no way out. How do you escape Stalin? And in an impulsive moment, she used this small Mauser pistol that her brother had given her to protect herself in the somewhat violent days of 1932. She committed suicide. It was tragic. Immediately, the organs, as they're called, closed the story. It was reputed that she had died of appendicitis. And there is, for me, this extraordinary moment when Marcia Peshkova, who's the granddaughter of the writer Gorky, describes how she, 7 years old, went to see Svetlana, who was six, and Svetlana was cutting up a black dress. And when Marfa said, "What are you doing?" Svetlana replied, "This is my mummy's dress. My mummy's dead. I want my dolls to wear my mummy's dress." Somehow the loneliness of that comment just strikes me as heartbreaking. And she wasn't told until she discovered at the age of 16 that her mother had committed suicide. And that discovery was also a betrayal. Can you imagine thinking all this time that your mother had died naturally and then realizing that she had, in her way, abandoned you? So it was quite a beginning. And, you know, after the age of 6 and a half, Svetlana would say that her life that had been idyllic up to that time, the happy family, the time spent in the dacha in the countryside, suddenly turned black. And the tragedies accumulated.
They did. I mean, they affected almost all of her family, many people in her family, and her own life was quite tragic. And yet also filled in a way with her indomitable spirit. Where did she get that from?
It is a puzzle. I mean, the capacity for optimism. I think her friend, a Mexican diplomat in London, put it well, that she was never running from, she was always running towards the life she imagined. I can only speculate that she had that nanny, you know, the kind of Mary Poppins nanny, who gave her a grounding of love, of care, of loyalty, of morality that she held to. It is also to be said that her mother, Nadia, was a disciplined, I want to avoid the word ideological, but she was a disciplined communist and brought her daughter up with a rigorous education, governess. Svetlana could speak German, and at the age of six, she had learned to play the piano. So our notion of what life inside the Kremlin would have been like is not entirely accurate. There was a very careful domestic life that was being pursued as Stalin was off in the Kremlin with his policies of the terror of the late 30s, of the cosmopolitan plot of the late 40s. And meanwhile, there's this family centered around the Aleluyevs with grandmother, grandfather, and sisters and brothers of Nadia, and then this remarkable nanny who was always there for Svetlana. Svetlana said that when her nanny died, it was the first person she was devastated by the loss of, because it was her whole universe, that woman who had been so caring of her. So I think that moral grounding was there. It does feel like a Dostoevsky or a Tolstoy novel, her life, that there's this political intrigue, this element of violence, political violence, and yet at the same time, this other domestic world that has a kind of sanity to it. I think her grandparents were also a great influence in keeping her grounded. But, I mean, imagine at the age of 11, suddenly her favorite uncle and aunt are sent off to the Gulag and executed in 1941 and 1942. And then when she's 16 and falls in love with a very charming filmmaker, much older than she, Stalin has him sent to the Gulag for the temerity of having a platonic love affair with his daughter. Each time some positive element of her life seemed to be blossoming, it would be sabotaged right up to the end. And as you say, what is the indomitable aspect of her spirit? I think that, in fact, she did have something that I have found before in the Russian temperament. When you're confronted by, as, say, the dissident writer Sinyavsky was, palpable evil, you have to confront it with the good. So there was a spiritual element to Svetlana, where she believed that you only survived if you could affirm life. And she managed to do it her whole life.
She also had a complex relationship with her father. I mean, of course, he was responsible for the death of millions of people, not just through the outright terror, but also the policies against the peasantry, the kulaks. So talk about that complicated relationship, the mixtures of yearning, submission, defiance that she had with him, and affection.
Yes. You know, her friend Rifkina said that Svetlana was emotionally orphaned. She lost her mother at 6 and a half, and the only one there who replaced her mother, apart from the anchor of her nanny, was her father. And witnesses of the time, whether it was Khrushchev or the Georgian Chakvianny, said that in his way, Stalin tried to be a father to her. So there are these loving letters from the child, Svetlana, 7-year-old, to her father in Sochi, saying, "Dearest Popochka, I miss you, I need you, there's wolves in the trees," and he would send her tangerines. She felt that from the age of 6 and a half to 15, he tried to be her father. And then when the lights went off and she saw that he could exile Alexei Kapler, the filmmaker she fell in love with, to the Gulag so casually, she understood during the period of the late 40s, which was called the anti-cosmopolitan plot, that people's lives depended on her father. She began to understand just what the drive to power had turned her father into. So I think by the end of her life, she always repudiated his policies, but wanted to feel that he had begun as a good man, a father who loved her, and been turned into something else. And she tried to hold on to that good part. But by the end, you would find that there was no picture of Stalin in her bedroom as an old woman. She had her mother, she had her grandmother, she had her daughter, two daughters and son, no picture of Stalin. And by the end, she repudiated him completely. But it's hard to imagine how conflicted you would be if you had a domestic relationship with your father and you knew him to be loving of you, and that was the only blood love almost that she could hold on to, and yet at the same time you understood and repudiated him publicly and in every other way, including defecting to the United States, for which she was sure her father would have had her killed, though luckily he was long dead. The conflict was just unbearable because she lost all of those beautiful memories you can retain from childhood. Once her father, she had learned to drive and her father drove with her, and that memory of her father driving with her, impressed by her driving, with the guard with the rifle sitting in the back seat. So what you're describing, that double submissive, rebellious, that conflict in her is established very early in that relationship with her father. And for me, you know, the portrait of women, you say I wrote a book about romantic obsession, trying to understand the female psyche, especially in our relationship to men, is very complex.
Could you say more about that? In other words, how you've generalized.
Well, it's interesting that the dictator's son, Vasily, turned out to be a tin pot imitation of his father, responsible for sending people to prison, though he didn't have much power, drinking himself to death at the age of 42, but assuming that as the son of Stalin, as the son of the Generalissimo, he had the right to assert his position in the world. Svetlana wanted to be the good girl. She wanted to be loved. Being loved was more important than power. And that's a dilemma that I think women get caught in. And I think, therefore, women are the more compassionate. Well, we cannot make gender generalizations, but I do find that the desire to make love the center of your life makes women's lives more complex.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Rosemary Sullivan. Her book is Stalin's Daughter, The Extraordinary and Tumultuous Life of Svetlana Aleluyeva. Now, she, as you mentioned, she had two children in Russia. She had another daughter in the United States. Her children in Russia, she left them behind, in a way, recapitulated, in some sense, her mother's abandonment of her with her abandonment of them. I mean, they were both still young. They were teenagers. And then she had a third daughter. I wonder if you could talk about her complicated relationships with her own children.
We're not used to, as North Americans, understanding how the state can enter into your lives. Svetlana defected on an impulse. She had been in a common law, loving relationship with an Indian man called Brajev Singh, but she was refused the right by the Kremlin to marry him because she was Stalin's daughter. He was ill. She wanted to take him to India where she thought he could get better. They refused. Then she asked, once he died, if she could take his ashes back, and they said yes. Why? For political reasons, because there were connections to the Gandhi government. She finds herself in New Delhi and just gets fed up with the control of her life by outside powers and walks impulsively into the American embassy and asks for asylum. It didn't occur to her as she was leaving. It wasn't a deliberate act. If it had been, she would have taken her children's pictures and so on. And she thought that that her children could understand. Her daughter was 17. Her son was 21. 22, actually. She knew that, felt, and accurately, that there would be no serious consequences to them of her defection. I don't think she knew. She wrote a wonderful letter to Boris Pasternak, a kind of elegiac letter since Pasternak was dead, but talking about his Dr. Zhivago and how you get cornered into choices that are unfair because of the politics that are dictating your life. So she did not anticipate that she would not be able to talk to her children for 17 years and did everything in those years to try to get word to her children that she was fine, to protect them by her silence. So there's letters from her son Joseph in which he talks about needing his mother and not understanding that loss. And yet it was never a failure of love on her part, I don't think. At the age of 45, with a total shock, she found herself pregnant by her husband, her then-husband, Wesley Peters. And it was a great gift because she felt that America had given her a child. One of the things you do when you write biography, of course, is the first thing you do is you make sure that you have access to the unpublished documents of the subject. And so I wrote to Svetlana's daughter, Chris, and told her I wanted to do this book. Could I meet her? When I met her, I was really blown away because she's everything I admire in an American. She's forthright, direct, compassionate. She's funny. You know that her favorite thing to do is stand-up comedy. And she's as American as, forgive the cliche, apple pie. And I thought, how did Svetlana achieve that? And furthermore, our notion that genetic inheritance is dictates who we are seemed to be completely belied by her daughter, Chris. So if you think of yourself as someone who's the daughter of one of the worst dictators responsible for the death of millions. And then you think of how she tried to negotiate that balance between a freedom for herself so that she could be almost cleansed of her father's name. At the end of her life, she was saying, if my books could be known and it could be known that I stood against my father's policy, that would justify my life. And yet at the same time, trying constantly to create this domestic, private world, a husband, children, etc. It was an astonishing thing to try to negotiate, and that she kept trying to negotiate it was amazing. I mean, I can't imagine anybody's luck, if that's the right word, being worse. She found, you know, when she was 61, a man she fell in love with, Tom, and he dies of cancer within the year. How could you survive these things and keep going?
We're talking with Rosemary Sullivan about Stalin's Daughter, her fascinating new biography of Svetlana Stalin, out from HarperCollins. The release date is June 2nd. In fact, the kindest men that she became involved with were Braja Singh, who also died within 3 years of their getting together.
Yes.
And Tom died of cancer. Yes. The other men, much more... disasters, I'd say. I did not know that she got involved with Frank Lloyd Wright's widow, was set up by his widow in a disastrous marriage that was the father of her American daughter.
With Wesley Peters, yes.
Yes. I mean, what an amazing chapter. I wonder if you could just tell us a bit about what happened there.
Well, it may also not be generally known that when Svetlana walked into the embassy in India asking for asylum, the remarkable ambassador, Chester Bowles, immediately facilitated her leaving completely legally from India for the United States. And then it turned out that the State Department didn't want her. So she got parked in Switzerland, and there had always been this rumor that Stalin, it was false, but that Stalin had left gold in Switzerland in the eventuality that the Germans defeated Russia in the Second World War. So suddenly, as Svetlana was in Switzerland, supposedly collecting her father's gold, she was also paid $1.5 million for her memoir, and arrived in the United States on a tourist visa as a wealthy woman. And Olga Vanna Wright, the widow of Frank Lloyd Wright by that time, needed benefactors, and she was Montenegrin. She came up with this notion that her own daughter had been called Svetlana, had died in a car accident. Svetlana Aluluyeva had arrived to replace her, and she had this scheme which was confirmed by alumni of Taliesin that Svetlana should marry Wesley Peters and become a member of the foundation, and her money would then become available to the fellowship. So this is exactly what happened, and Svetlana walked right into it. She met Wesley Peters. Within 3 weeks, she was married to him. Again, that was part of the complexity of Svetlana's psyche, always looking for that safe domestic haven. So when the idea of marriage came up, she jumped, and then discovered, you know, within 2 years that, in fact, she had been married for her money. So it was another heartbreak, but it was in a way almost programmed to happen. What was ironic about it was that it wasn't Svetlana who called Olga Vanna the Tsarina of Taliesin, but it was run like a mini version of her father's court. The dinners, more elegant in Taliesin than they had been in Russia, were the same, controlled by Svetlana. Svetlana couldn't believe that she had walked into the only place in America which would be an imitation of her father's court.
Right. Controlled by Olga Vanna, by the widow. Yes.
Sorry, did I say Svetlana? Controlled by Olga Vanna, yes.
Yeah, incredible story. And, you know, I remember hearing about Svetlana when, maybe after she defected, I'd say maybe in the mid to late 70s, and my impression of her was always that she was a little unstable, mm-hmm. and she's a much richer person in this book, but she never escaped from the shadow of her father in a way that was cast over how people saw her. To me, it seems that that is really uniquely her tragedy, her struggle to be taken on her own terms.
I always resist as a biographer those words like manic depressive, unstable, etc. Only because as a biographer, one wants to tell the narrative. And the narrative indicates, I think it's Chris, her daughter, who tells it most eloquently, that there were moments when Svetlana would, and you couldn't always tell what provoked it, but fall into the night terrors of a child. It's hard for us to imagine. How can you have a history that involves your mother's suicide at 6 and a half, the murder of many of your relatives, the loss of friends, the defection that really was badly handled? She didn't come to the United States as a principal defector, but as a woman, a millionaire selling a book. It turned out that the copyright to her book was given to an irrevocable trust, so she had no rights to it. What I see is a woman who had amazing anger that she had to control. And when people called her crazy, and she had two actually bête noires, one in particular was a journalist, Patricia Blake, who talked often about that in the press, about her instability. But frankly, I think she was remarkably constrained in some ways, given the level of anger she was justified in feeling. At the same time, Svetlana could never calculate. She was a gambler. To me, one of the remarkable things was as she lost her money and became poorer and poorer, one reason being that she always insisted her daughter had to have the best education, so she would use her meager resources to send her daughter to private school. By 1984, she had finally given up, and she decided to redefect to the Soviet Union, and then again understood that she'd made a terrible mistake. So to me, instability might not be the right word I would attach to Svetlana, but an impulsiveness, an incapacity to calculate. And also, she didn't have the understanding that you have to have as a North American. She didn't know what money was. I mean, in North America, we understand that money is freedom, security. She was so impulsive and unwise about money that she never created any security for herself. But I find the final image of Svetlana, who could rage in a minute, and, you know, if you crossed her, if you raised her expectations and failed her, silence would follow for years. But the image of her as an old-age pensioner with very little money, but still generous, still giving, you know, her last $100 to, you know, take care of cats and so on. That strange impulsiveness is part of it. There were two versions of Svetlana. One is the one you describe, the public idea that she was somehow crazy. And then there was the British version. When I spoke to the Dowager Lady Pamela Egremont, she said, oh, my God, no, she was as stable as a rock. Or when I spoke to Lady Vanessa Thomas, she said, oh, all that Russian drama, I never took that seriously. The next thing, after Svetlana raged about something, maybe you'd exposed her address to the public by mistake, then she'd turn around and she'd be fine. So the British version of Svetlana, she was actually kind of solid, though she was the last survivor, as it were, a lost fish out of water, as one of the people I interviewed said, always, always seen as Stalin's daughter, even by the most affectionate people, because it was not a projection you could withdraw. You always began by seeing her as Stalin's daughter.
Well, Rosemary Sullivan, your book, Stalin's Daughter, really gives the full measure of this fascinating person. She did have an extraordinary and tumultuous life, and it's just a terrific read. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about it.
Thank you so much.
Rosemary Sullivan. You can read an excerpt from Stalin's Daughter by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, Elena Gorokova's memoir, Russian Tattoo. Stay tuned.
Mine, I have it, they're full flat. Hit back to you as it's on.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Elena Gorokhova first came to the U.S. in 1980, she left behind the constraints and security of Soviet Russia for the dizzying choices and insecurities of the U.S. It was both exhilarating and frightening. She'd come as a new bride with her American husband, but the marriage quickly fell apart. She eventually remarried, had a daughter, and settled into a satisfying life in her new land. But her old land continued to exert a powerful pull on her psyche. Gorokhova's sensitive new memoir, Russian Tattoo, continues where her first memoir ended. That one, A Mountain of Crumbs, was about her life in the Soviet Union. This one explores the ambivalent territory that immigrants must traverse and illuminates what our society feels like to the outsider. It's a wonderful read. When I spoke with Elena Gorokhova earlier this month, I started out by asking her how she had met her first husband, the event that started her on her journey to the U.S.
We met in Russia, in Leningrad. At that time, the city was called Leningrad. It was impossible in the Soviet Union to leave the country unless one marries a foreigner. So he was there learning Russian in a summer program that was taught at the Leningrad University. And then he came back and we got married also in Russia. And then it took me about 6 months to collect the papers for me to be able to leave for the United States.
Give us a brief snapshot of what life was like at that time.
It was a dictatorial regime with closed borders where foreigners were allowed to visit the country, but there were very few of them, and no information, no kind of media, no books that were banned in the Soviet Union at the time were allowed to cross the border. So if anyone, for example, a foreigner was visiting Russia and was, let's say, entering the country with a tome of Solzhenitsyn, that book would be confiscated at the border. As well as, you know, all the magazines, those glossy magazines that we have, they were not allowed into the country either. So nothing Western was allowed. So we were very cut off from the entire world. And the information that I had about the West, it was very scarce, but the reason I had any information was because I graduated from the English department of the university, so we had a little more access to books that were circulated, that were sort of semi-banned books that were circulated among, let's say, faculty and students of the English department because we could read English. So we knew a little bit more than an average citizen did.
Did you marry Robert because you wanted to get away?
You know, it's a very insightful question, and I've been asking this question myself. I wanted to get away from the oppressive regime, definitely, from all these lies. There is a Russian word, vranyo, which means lies, basically. And we knew that the state was lying to us, and the state knew that they were lying to us, and everyone knew everything, but they kept lying anyway, and we pretended to believe them. It was almost a game. We knew that what you're telling us is not true, but we know you have to tell us this, and we just went on living like that. It was almost, almost a schizophrenic existence. The way I felt it was I sliced my soul in half. One half was for my friends and for the family, for those close to whom you could tell the truth, what you thought. And the other was for the outside world, for those people you worked with, for the bureaucracy, when you pretended, you know, what they expected of you. So it was pretty difficult to exist like that, as you can imagine. And I wanted to leave that, but I also lived with my mother, who was a very typical Russian and Soviet mother. In my mind, she was a mirror image of my motherland. She was overbearing, protective, and difficult to leave. And looking back, I realized that, yes, I wanted to leave the country, but I also wanted to run away from my mother. So there were these two forces that propelled me out of the country. But then Robert showed up and we met, and he was actually a brilliant person. He's a physicist, he's a musician, he was a writer. So I was attracted to him. There was definitely this attraction, and I wanted to be with him, and I had great respect for him. But and he was very exotic because he came from the country about which we knew nothing.
Yes, and when you came here, things kind of fell apart between the two of you. But before we get to that, I want to come back to this point that you made about lying, because you also wrote a very interesting op-ed in the New York Times in 2011 when Putin came back into power. And you talked again about the lying, and you said, you know, that you first assumed that everybody who saw Putin knew that he was lying. But then you thought, no, maybe they don't.
Because there's a new generation. The Berlin Wall came down in 1989. The Soviet Union, there was that coup where Gorbachev was taken from power. Basically, when the Soviet Union collapsed in a matter of 3 or 4 days. And that was in 1991. And that's when everything changed for Russia. That's when there was no more Soviet Union, when the country shrank at the borders. So everyone who was born after 1980, I would say, because Gorbachev came to power, I believe it was 1985. And when he came to power, he started perestroika. And that changed. He allowed a lot of things to be published. There were no banned books anymore. He allowed people to travel abroad. So there was this huge paradigmal change in the country. So anyone who was born after 1980 did not know communism, did not know the Soviet Union, or did not live under that dictatorship and those lies that I lived under. So I was just wondering that when Putin came to power in 2000, he was presiding, in addition to, you know, all the people of my age and my mother's age, he was presiding over this new generation of people who did not know what communism was. And I was wondering if they, do they really know this lies, this vranyo, when, you know, they're lying to us and we know they're lying and they know they're lying, but we pretend to believe them. I don't think those people. And I know that this new generation does not know what it was. My very good friend who still lives in Russia has a son who was born in 1980, just when I was leaving the country. And he's, I think, a good representative of this new generation. He knows nothing about the Soviet Union, about dictatorship, about Stalin's terror. He knows it as history, but not as his own history. He knows it as history on the page of a history book. And I think that was really a very interesting sort of difference about the perception of lying that I tried to explore in that article.
Yes, and I guess those of us who look at Putin, I mean, I certainly didn't live in Russia. I've never been to Russia, but I probably see him, and I'm sure you see him, with different eyes than they do. I mean, it seems to me that in many ways he's bringing back the old regime under a different cloak.
He certainly is. That is very accurate, I think. Well, he was a KGB lieutenant colonel. He worked for the KGB when the Soviet Union collapsed, and I think that says it all. He said, and this is a quote, that he considers the collapse, the disintegration of the Soviet Union, to be the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. So I think he was, from the very beginning, he was planning to do everything to bring back that old, mighty Soviet Union that he remembered and he worked for. And I think that's what he's doing. That's exactly what he's doing with Ukraine. That's what he did with Georgia a few years before. That's what he's doing with having a next Crimea. He's just bringing this power back.
So now back to you and this wonderful memoir. And this is the second memoir. It's like the follow-up to your first memoir, which was A Mountain of Crumbs. You're now in the United States. What an amazing culture shock.
It really was. The first memoir, A Mountain of Crumbs, ended with a scene at the airport in Leningrad when the protagonist says goodbye to the country and to family and friends. But, of course, I realized looking back that this is not where the story ended. Maybe this is where the story began. And when I came to this country, it was a tremendous culture shock. It was still 1980. I came literally from behind the Iron Curtain. I didn't know anything. I didn't know how to take a bus. I didn't know you had to flag them down. In New Jersey, that's what you have to do for the bus to stop. I had never seen a hamburger. I didn't know how to eat one. I had never taken a multiple choice exam. So when I tried to get a driver's license, I was completely perplexed by all these ABCDs. My biggest sort of this catastrophic humiliation was in a shoe store when I walked into a shoe store and it was full of shoes. because in the Soviet Union, the stores were empty. And it was a shock. It was culture shock on many different levels to me.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Elena Gorokova about her new memoir, Russian Tattoo. You know, in some ways, it feels to me in reading your book that, yes, you had a culture shock, and I think Americans could say, oh, now she came to the land of choice, and she came to the land of freedom. But it's not so simple as that. There were things about the old Soviet Union that in some way you yearned for, and there were things about America that were not so comfortable, although you have clearly made your choice to stay here. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, the nuances, this immigrant experience that you have that's heightened because of the different systems and what might have been lost and what might have been gained.
Yes, the question of many choices is a very double-edged sword, I think, or it was to me when I came here. Making a choice was very difficult for me, and it manifested itself in every store I went into. I almost yearned for fewer choices so that I didn't have to think that much, or I didn't have to look at this, that, and the other, you know, at 50 pairs of shoes as opposed to maybe two or three. It was on a very concrete level. It was very difficult. Just buying food, there were so many different foods, so many different brands of the same food. That's what was, to me, very confusing and very disturbing, to choose between what seemed to me were very similar things. But then also, of course, choice was everywhere. There was a choice to, you know, to go to this university or that university for my graduate degree. And I didn't understand that. In Russia, we had, you know, we had one university in Leningrad, and it was a very good school. So if they admitted you, you were very lucky and you felt great. And that's where you wanted to be. But here, I was told you can go here and there, but here it costs this much, and there they give you financial aid, but here they don't. And there were so many subtle things that I just couldn't deal with. It was very difficult. Also, the idea of taking on a debt was completely alien. In Russia, it was just, at the time, it was not done. It was so alien. So I couldn't even imagine taking a loan to go to graduate school. And then looking for a job, for example, that, you know, I had no idea how one looks for a job here. In Russia, you have a job for the rest of your life, basically. Most people, once you graduate from a university, you are put on a track, and that's where you are. You're going to be on that track for the rest of your life. You will be at the same job, most likely. You will live in the same apartment. I knew that if I had stayed, I would be in that apartment until I died. Even if I married, I would either go to my husband's apartment and live with his parents, or he would come to me and live with my parents, my mother. Everything was decided. There was, you know, there was this security in a way. There was this safety that you couldn't look outside of this box that we were in. And on one hand, it's very stifling, as you can imagine, and it limits you. On the other hand, it gives you security, and there is this protectiveness that, you know, the state will always make sure that you are not hungry and you have a place to live. There was this minimal security. So it was like, you know, someone dropped you into an ocean and said, you know, now swim. I was very untethered to anything. It was very frightening for the first few months, especially.
And also frightening because your marriage broke up. So tell us about that and then how you began to find your way.
My first husband, Robert, in the book, was, as I said, he was a brilliant man in his own right and in what he did, but he didn't know how to help a person from a different culture. He didn't know how to help me. And, you know, I had to sort of figure out my own way, and it was hard. And I was in Texas, if you can imagine being in Texas, just from the Soviet Union. We were living in Austin, and I was trying to find a job because we needed money. He was a graduate student at the University of Austin, of Texas at Austin. And I would come for an interview, and I didn't have clothes. I just had one summer dress that I brought with me, and nobody would even think of hiring me. So I ended up working in a pizzeria, and I was a total disaster. I burned pizza slices. I had no, you know, I was thinking of other things like GRE exams instead of looking at my watch to see when the pizza was ready. So it was a difficult time. And then he realized that he couldn't help me. So he sent me to his mother who lived in New Jersey. And, you know, she was very nice and helpful. But then that's when it started to unravel. That's when we drifted more and more apart. As you can imagine, we're not even living in the same state. So that lasted for a few months, and I was still trying to find a teaching job or to find a job that would be more professional. I was working in New Jersey. I was working in a restaurant as a waitress. And that in Bistic, Charles, there was this big place where they had steaks and shrimp, and it was a huge operation. And it was now I realize how valuable that experience was. At the time, I was miserable, and I was a miserable waitress, but there were so many people who worked there, students from Trenton State College at the time, who helped me and picked up after me and just taught me all kinds of things in a very subtle way that now, looking back, it was funny. It was a funny experience because I didn't know anything. I didn't know the names of drinks, and I was just failing completely as a waitress. But it was funny. As a chapter in the book, looking back at it, I smile. But I met a number of very, very helpful, very kind and wonderful people there. And then I met my second husband, who taught me a lot and who sort of explained things to me and showed me how to do things. And then when I understood how one looks for a job and how one writes a resume and what an interview is like, it became much easier.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Elena Gorokova about her second memoir. It's Russian Tattoo. It's about what happened after she came to the United States from the Soviet Union in 1980. Now, you said at one point that you knew in Russia how everyone felt about everything, even though, you know, everybody was lying. There was this vranyo. But you knew how everyone felt, whereas in America, you often couldn't read people's true feelings. And that really struck me, because I think in many ways, there's plenty of lying in this country, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The feeling that I had in the first few months here, I remember very clearly, is that it took me a while. There was this notion of social courtesy in this country when a person may be, you know, angry or especially in a situation, let's say in the office or in some kind of a bureaucratic situation or at a store, but the person is not going to raise his or her voice or is not going to yell at you. In Russia, there was no social courtesy at all under communism. There was no such thing. And you knew when you went into a store to buy something that the store clerk is going to be rude, and you expected that. And if you asked for something, you would probably, the clerk would not do it for you, but instead would ridicule you in front of the whole line. If you didn't have exact change and they wanted exact change, they would also be angry at you and, you know, throw things at you. But that was expected. So when I came here, everything was so nice. Everyone was smiling, and there was no rudeness anywhere. Or at least I didn't see it, you know, because I was not able to look under the surface. I didn't know how to read certain things. And it took me, well, obviously it took me a while. Now I know what I can read, I think, as well as a person born here, what is happening and what the situation is, and if there is a tension, I could feel it. But back then I couldn't. As far as lying, yes, absolutely. I think there is probably lying everywhere, and when you realize in this country with what went on with the Iraq war and how we got into Iraq and all that, of course, there is lying. But I think the difference is, and still is, between Russia and any Western democracy is that in Russia, lying is institutionalized. There is no recourse. There is no system that has the safeguards that would protect you or expose the lies. For example, talking in this country, we talk about the Iraq war and how we were drawn into it under false pretenses. We talk about Abu Ghraib, and there is a discussion. And, you know, obviously there are people who think one way or the other way, and there is no one opinion. But just the fact that we're talking about it, that there is a dialogue going on, is something that would be impossible in Russia. No one is talking right now there's no dialogue about Crimea, there's no dialogue about Ukraine, there is no dialogue about Georgia, and anyone who says anything against the actions of the government is considered a traitor, and the term they're using now is fifth columnists. So anyone who questions Putin's government is a fifth columnist, is a traitor. And I think that's the huge difference. You know, when I think and when I read what is happening in Russia right now, I almost feel ashamed of being Russian and speaking that language and having lived there. I am sorry to say.
Wow, that's a very powerful thing to say. And something I think of the strong undercurrent of identity that does come through. I mean, you say in your book that, you know, your Russian self is your inheritance and it's rooted in your veins.
Yes, that's true. That's how I feel. I feel that, well, I think I will always be Russian. It's because I came here when I was 24, so I was formed in that culture. And maybe I shouldn't just be so bitter, and maybe I should separate the culture from the country, from the system, from the political system, from the gang of thugs that usurped it, you know, this government that is at power in Russia now. Because the culture, the Russian culture, nobody is going to, you know, to take that away. The books that I was raised with, the theater, the hermitage, the art, and my city, which I think is unique. It's a beautiful city. If you ever have a chance to go, it's beautiful architecturally. It's beautiful in a very harmonic way, in a very European way. And it's full of history, it's full of culture, and it's mine. It's mine as much as it is anyone else's who lives there at the present time. So I do consider myself Russian. I think I will always be. Russian is my first language, and it will always be there. I can read and write in English, but I will always speak with an accent. That will not go anywhere. So there is almost the splitness of soul that will always be there. I think that immigrants have this split soul, and the longer you live in an adopted country, I think the deeper your roots grow into the foreign soil. But that scar that marks the divide, that divide of the split soul, with time it scabs over, but it doesn't go away. And I truly believe that. I think that all immigrants have this wound in their soul. And I think it's, you know, it's not a bad thing. It is there. It's just there, and I feel it very acutely. I live with it.
And I don't think we'll have time to talk about your mother, which is just a wonderful discussion in the book. But I do want to talk about your daughter, because in some way she represents, I think, some healing of those two parts, ultimately. Although when she grew up, she didn't want to have anything to do with your mother country.
True, true. She was very antagonistic, in fact. And I think it was probably my fault, because I forced her to learn Russian. I wanted her to be bilingual and bicultural like me. And, you know, she grew up speaking Russian. Actually, Russian was literally her first language. She started to speak in Russian because my mother and I read books to her in Russian constantly when she was an infant. So when she started to speak, it was in Russian. And English came a little later. But then, of course, when she went to school, it all changed. She didn't want to be like her parent and like her grandmother. She wanted to be like her peers. And nobody in her school spoke another language. So she started to protest when I, you know, and I read to her in Russian, and I taught her how to read and write. And when it got to the academic skills, to reading and writing, I realized that I needed to maintain her Russian. And the only way to do that in my mind was to sort of sit her down once a week or twice a week and do some exercises and read some stories in Russian. And she perceived that as extra work, and it was. And more she started to reject it. And finally, when she was old enough, she put her foot down and she said, I don't want to do this anymore. She was a very strong teenager, and that created sort of a negativity in our relationship. And it lasted for a while, and it made me very upset that she would reject this Russian heritage. And, of course, I thought she was rejecting me and my mother. But finally, I realized that our relationship was more important than the language, and I stopped. I just stepped back. But interestingly, when she became a university student, she picked up voluntarily. She enrolled in some Russian courses. She studied Russian there when she was maybe 19 or 20. She read Anna Karenina in Russian. And then she asked me to take her to Russia. And we went to Petersburg together a few years ago. And she was able to speak on the street. She was able to communicate. And that was healing. Yes, that's a good word. That was very, to me, that was very important.
Well, it's a terrific memoir, Elena Gorokova, Russian Tattoo. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
In addition to Russian Tattoo, Elena Gorokova is the author of another memoir, A Mountain of Crumbs. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.